Good morning. It's 9 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'll be filling in for Joy Cardine today. The future of marriage is up for discussion this hour. It is the title of the latest book by David Blankenhorn, who is the head of the Institute for American Values. It's a nonpartisan group devoted to research and publications on family and civil society issues. He is also the author, by the way, of Fatherless America, published a few years back. In his new book, Blankenhorn takes us on a trip that visits marriage throughout history. How the definitions of marriage have changed, why they've changed, and where we find ourselves now. And he also argues that countries that are supportive of the idea of gay marriage are also the places where the support of marriage itself is weakest. As many states continue to grapple with the issue of gay marriage, he also argues that the future of marriage itself is not about defending or stopping gay marriage. What are your views on marriage? Blankenhorn will offer up his definition that we'll be discussing, and as you listen, you'll have to decide whether it matches yours. Or perhaps you think there is more than one definition, and Blankenhorn's doesn't match any of them. Give us a call with your comments and questions at 800-642-1234. If you're calling from Madison, the number is 263-1890. Email works too, and if you'd like, we'll be happy to read your email on the air. talk@wpr.org is that address, and that is talk@wpr.org. David Blankenhorn, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, the one thing I have to say about your book off the top of my head is that if people are looking for a light read, this probably isn't it.
What did you think was heavy sledding? The Trobriand Islands, or ancient Mesopotamia, or I agree, it's got some parts in it that are about history, but I tried to pick some areas that I thought were illustrative of how marriage has changed and what the sort of essential nature of marriage is across human societies.
Why this conversation? Why are we having this now at this point in our history?
Because we're having a big debate about what marriage is. And I think so much of the future of the institution depends on what we decide that it really is. In particular, over the last several years, as we've discussed as a society the issue of extending equal marriage rights to gays and lesbians, there's been a lot of discussion that I actually find troubling that basically says that marriage is a private relationship between two adults. That's really what is repeatedly said by the proponents of this change. And part of the reason I spent a year going through all of the anthropological studies, which I try to sum up in the book, is that I wanted to see if that really was what marriage has been in human societies, and I really concluded that it isn't. And so while there is the history that you describe in the book, I looked at it from the point of view of just trying to say, if we look across human societies, and because marriage is one of the only human institutions that is, as far as we know, universal. All human groups that we know about have instituted something called marriage. So, what is the sort of essential cross-cultural core of this living arrangement? That's really the question that I was trying to answer in light of the current debate over shall we change the definition of marriage.
And let's talk about the beginning of the book, the genesis of it, because in the beginning of the book, you talk about having lunch, I think it was, with the executive director of Freedom to Marry, and it was at that lunch that you really kind of came to the decision that this was something that you needed to do. Tell us about the lunch and what the topic of discussion was and how you got to this place.
Well, Evan Wolfson is a guy I've gotten to know. He's the head of this group called Freedom to Marry, and he's the main legal strategist for the effort to have gay marriage in the U.S. He's kind of like Thurgood Marshall was to the civil rights movement of African Americans in the 40s and 50s. I mean, he really is playing that role of chief legal strategist. And he called me and wanted to talk, and he said, look, you're a guy who talks about fathers and marriage, and you need to be supportive of gay marriage for the following reasons. And he said, if you're not, it's going to happen with or without your support. And, you know, people who aren't ahead of this thing aren't going to have any influence on it and will be viewed by history as bigots. And so it was a challenging and bracing conversation. And afterwards, I decided I really needed to. And I was kind of undecided at the time. I didn't quite know what I thought. I was impressed by his passion, but I also was passionate about what I thought were some important issues related to the well-being of children. So I decided I would take a year or two and do the due diligence and try to study about, I mean, you know, I had spent years already thinking about issues of marriage and fatherhood, but to really go back and look at the anthropology on what is marriage and try to wrestle with the question of gay marriage in light of my concern for strengthening marriage as a pro-child social institution. So I'm really grateful to Evan in a way, because that conversation sort of caused me to write the book.
And I want to return to the issue of children there, because you bring that up very early in the book as being central in the whole idea of taking a look at marriage.
Right. Well, the thing that makes me interested in marriage in the first place is because it really is the issue of children. I mean, if our species did not reproduce sexually and did not give birth to these little helpless dependent creatures who were needy for long periods of time, you know, in other words, if new humans arrived to us via the stork, you know, more or less fully formed, we definitely would not have an institution called marriage. We would probably be doing many interesting things as humans, but getting married would not be one of them. So the connection between marriage and how we identify the parents of children and how we raise children is really a subject that, that's the essence of it for me. So that's really what I wanted to look at. And the reason that I'm not supportive of redefining marriage to allow gay and lesbian couples to marry, the reason I do not support that change is not because I have anything against committed gay and lesbian relationships, et cetera. The reason I'm against it is because I think it would weaken this sort of pro-child, it would weaken marriage as a social institution. What it would do was in law and in custom, it would accelerate our understanding of marriage. It's just a word that we give to more or less any committed adult relationship that wants to call itself marriage. And that's really not historically what marriage has been. So I think it would do what scholars call deinstitutionalized marriage. It would turn it from a structured, coherent social institution that exists for public purposes, principally child-rearing, and it would sort of redefine it as just a name that we give to a private adult relationship that has some element of commitment to it. And I think that in the process of making that change, that would weaken it, the institution, and then we would result in more children growing up in one-parent or no-parent homes. So that's really the nut of it for me.
We're going to be getting to callers in just a second. I want to give out the phone numbers again. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number that you can use. In Madison, it is 263-1890. And in the book, you actually ask the question, what is marriage? And there's no short answer for it in your book. You go into a great deal of detail in getting to the nub of things. And, for a lot of people, when you listen to the debate on this, because it has been debated a lot, the answers are very short and very succinct, and yours is not necessarily so.
Well, the reason yes, that's exactly right. And I think that when you say that marriage is commitment, or marriage is an expression of love between two individuals, those are, you know, that's fairly close to a kind of a Hallmark greeting definition, and it doesn't really get us very far. I mean, if marriage is an expression of love, if marriage means a relationship of commitment and interdependence between two adults, Well, I have lots of relationships, and I'm not even a particularly gregarious person, and I have a number of relationships in my life that easily fit that definition, but I'm not married to those people. So we have to dig a little bit deeper. And so rather than going through the religious traditions or the various, you know, national cultural traditions, I chose the field of anthropology because that's the one discipline we have. It's a secular social science, and it looks cross-culturally. It says, what's the common feature across human societies? And the great anthropologists of the modern era have been pretty consistent about this. And what they say marriage is social approval of a sexual relationship between a man and a woman. They say, you know, marriage is when society says we recognize and ratify and support and encourage this sexual relationship between a man and a woman. And the reason we do it is primarily so that any children born in our society are going to have an identifiable legal mother and an identifiable legal father who are there to raise that child in a partnership that's public and legal and structured. And so the anthropologist in society A and society B, marriage may also have other purposes. It has there are economic dimensions, there are extended kinship dimensions, there are the personal and loving relationship between the husband and spouse, husband and wife. There are many other aspects of it, but the one universal cross-cultural essence of the thing is that all the children born in our society, we want to have a legal and socially defined mother and father who are there for the child and there for each other. That's what so really, I think that's a good place to start. And when we just say, and if we want to, and that doesn't mean that we have to stay with that definition or we have to, you know, that doesn't close the conversation. But as we have the conversation, it strikes me that at least we should recognize that this has been the fundamental denominator of marriage as a human institution since we've had marriage. And it just strikes me as like, can't we at least take that into account as we have our current discussion?
We're talking with David Blankenhorn right now. He is the author of the newly released book, The Future of Marriage, and we'll be taking your phone calls. We do have a lot of listeners who would like to get in on the conversation. We're going to take a break right now, and when we return, we will continue. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 24 minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. Former Vice President Al Gore went before Congress yesterday, urging action against what he calls a climate crisis. Coming up after 9 this morning, Kathleen Dunn and her guests talk about the politics behind global warming. That's up in just about 35 minutes here on the Ideas Network. For the rest of this hour, we are talking with David Blankenhorn, author of the newly published book, The Future of Marriage, and we'll be taking your calls in just a moment. David Blankenhorn, before we get to the calls, I want to ask about the general reaction to your book so far. It's only been really released in the last week or two. And I'm wondering, you know, because elements of this are going to be controversial. There's just no two ways about it.
Right.
And, you know, how's the reaction been?
So far, it's been good. I had a debate with Evan Wolfson at Pace Law School last week, and they're going to put it on C-SPAN was there, and it was a good conversation. I mean, part of the reason I approach the public discussion of this book with a fair amount of trepidation, to be honest. I mean, when I did Fatherless America, I just loved every minute of the public conversation, but this one makes me nervous because I hate, you know, the idea of being thought of as a bigoted person or being anti-gay, and the whole thing was troubling to me, as it's troubling to so many people who try to think through this issue. But so far, I've been I've you know, I've been treated well and respectfully, and people seem to be open to listening to the argument. So I really don't have anything to complain about so far.
Let's see what listeners think. Marion joins us now from Crystal Lake, Illinois. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning. I have also thought a lot about this, and I agree with your person who talks about protection of children. I also think, though, that a lot of times, traditionally, marriage has also been protection of property. And what I think needs to be done, I think that we have that people, and I have to say, I am a church-going person. I've been married 30 years. I have three children. So I'm very traditional in my own life. But I think we need to separate out some sort of legal protection for gay couples that involves at least medical issues and inheritance of property. We have a lot of laws on the books that talk about protection of children. And while I agree completely with what has been said, I also think that we have a lot of divorce. We have a lot of single parenthood. It's an idealistic way of looking at things. I wish it worked. So that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to have some sort of a legal civil union that would deal with medical issues, inheritance of property. If you talk about Social Security, nobody wants to talk about that because it would be so expensive, as far as I can tell, politically. And that would be a killer, totally aside from religious issues. But there needs to be some sort of legal protection, and then let marriage be in the church, and all the churches can do it the way they want to do it. So that's what I have to say.
Marion, thanks for the call. David Blankenhorn, and there, I guess, in a nutshell, is one of the many arguments that we've been hearing throughout these debates. But, you know, advocates for gay marriage will say, well, a civil union just isn't the same thing, and marriage does have a meaning beyond that, and we should have access to that as well.
Right. Your caller makes several very interesting points. And the one about civil unions, the thing of it is you point out, the leaders of this movement do not want civil unions. They think that's second-class status. And I agree with them in this sense, that if you tell someone that you can have every benefit and responsibility of marriage, you're going to be married in every single way that we can specify, except one, is that you can't use the word marriage. You can't call it marriage, which is mostly what these civil union proposals are. I think that is an invidious form of discrimination. Why would you tell someone, why would you all sit down and have a Chinese meal and say, everyone can enjoy this Chinese meal, including you, except you can't say that you're having a Chinese meal? Why would that? That seems arbitrary to me, and it does seem like an invidious form of discrimination. So I agree with my opponents in this debate, in a way, that if we can't figure out what marriage is, and we can't say that we're supportive of marriage and that marriage is a non-discriminatory institution the way it exists right now, if we can't figure that out as a society, then, let's have gay marriage and let's not fool around with these kind of, naming debates. Now, I take a different position. I think we ought to say what marriage is, and we ought to say that it's not a discriminatory institution, and we ought not change the definition of it. But playing around with the names doesn't strike me as a good way to do it.
Let's go on, take another call right now. Andy is with us from Clintonville. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning. Thanks for having this program. It's a great topic. Earlier, your guest was talking about how society views marriage. And at one point, society said slavery was fine, or we approve of slavery. At another time, they said women shouldn't have the right to vote. We're allowed to grow and evolve as society, and I think it makes sense to start thinking about new ways to view this, different from how we viewed it 100 years ago. But the question I have, and the item I struggle with in this debate, is how my marriage is connected to somebody else's marriage that I don't know. So when people talk about the institution of marriage or how marriage is connected, other than my parents or maybe my close friends, I don't feel that my wife and I and how our marriage will work in the future is really connected to someone else out there that I don't know. And if it is, half the marriages are failing with heterosexuals. I'm not sure that that's the way I want to measure my marriage. And I just want to understand the connection between someone else's marriage and my own as we talk about the institution.
Andy, thanks for the call. David Blankenhorn, it sounds like a simple question, but there is a lot in there.
It's a fabulous question, and it probably gets to the very heart of this issue quicker than almost any other question, so I thank the caller for that. What I want to say to you, caller, is that your marriage is, whether you think it or not, or whether you wish it so or not, your marriage is a part of other people's. It's connected to other people's marriage, and it's connected to the status of marriage in our society. That's true of any shared way of living in society. That would be true of, I'm just trying to think of an analogy. Well, okay, let's look at it this way. Let's get off the issue of gay marriage for a moment. Let's take the issue of marital fidelity. And let's say you have let's say you're 20 years old, you're thinking about getting married, and your idea privately as an individual is that you think that when you get married, that means to be faithful to the other person sexually. Let's just say privately, for whatever odd reason, you happen to have that goal in life, that when you get married, you want sexual fidelity within marriage. Now, it's one thing if you just happen to believe it. That means that every person you date or consider forming a relationship with, you would need to say, well, gosh, just I'm a quirky person. I happen to believe that if we got married, we should be faithful to one another sexually. What do you think? And presumably there would be a range of answers, and many people would agree and many people would disagree, and you would just be out there fishing around. But that's really not how it works in marriage. And that's not how it works in the United States. That's not how it works anywhere in the world, to be honest. We can presume, as a general rule, that when you get married, the presumption of sexual fidelity is there because that's part of the institution. That's part of the rules of, that's one of the sort of rules and norms of marriage. So when you are dating someone or considering marrying someone, you can reasonably, to the degree that marriage is an authoritative institution and to the degree that it communicates its rules clearly, you can be confident that your prospective spouses also believe in the idea of marital fidelity, or at least they believe, at least they recognize that that's the social expectation, that that's what people normally expect. It doesn't mean they're going to not break the rule. It doesn't mean that there isn't individual variation, but there's a social norm. So it's not true that every little relationship is like a private little snowflake that has nothing to do with anything else. If you change the definition of marriage legally for the whole society, you're going to affect everyone's marriage, and you're going to affect the marriages that happen to the children of the current generation. So if there was one point I want to stress, because so many people say this. They say, well, to translate it into the gay marriage debate, people will say, what does it matter if a gay couple wants to get married? How does that affect my marriage? The answer is it definitely affects your marriage if we redefine marriage in our society for everyone. It definitely affects your marriage and the marriage that your children are going to have. So it's a great question, but I believe that the answer is completely clear-cut, that we're in this together in this marriage thing. It's not something that we do privately in secret that has no connection to anything else. There has to be shared values, or else the institution itself doesn't work.
But some people might argue that, okay, if the definition has changed and it affects my marriage, well, so what? This is just another step in the evolution of the definition.
Well, that was the other point the caller made,
yeah.
And you can certainly say that. And it's certainly true that we change our mind in society about many things. Just because we used to believe something doesn't mean that we have to believe it now. That's a perfectly valid point. The question I would ask is, do we want to change our minds about the issue of establishing this birthright for the child to have a mother and a father there for that child? Is that something we want to change? I'm glad we changed our minds on slavery. I'm glad we changed our minds on universal suffrage. I do not want us to change our minds about this great gift that we give our children. I think it would be a bad idea. And I would ask the caller and others to say, do we want to change our minds about this idea of, insofar as we can make it possible, we want every child born to have a legally identified mother and father in a coherent institution of marriage to raise them. And, you know, some people say, yes, we do want to change our minds on that. I say no, and that's the discussion we're having.
Let's find out what Jay in Wausau thinks. Good morning, Jay.
Yes, good morning. I have sort of two interrelated comments, one of which has been briefly touched on, but your guest has gone back to it here, which is the notion of marriage defined with relationship to children. And, you know, you're saying that you don't want to change the birthright to these children, that they will have a clear legally defined father and mother in an institution of marriage, but and that means that you don't want to change the institution, but essentially you would have to change the institution to illegalize divorce in order to give them this birthright. You know, divorce is prevalent in our society, and the fact that they are their parents are currently in the institution of marriage does not guarantee them anything under our current legal structure. And the second point that I'd like you to comment on is that, you know, marriage isn't just about children in its current form either. Elderly couples often have second marriages after their former spouses have passed on with no intention of having children. Younger couples get married with no intention of having children. Some of them, you know, are physically unable to have children, and they still find value in the institution of marriage as being a relationship between them and their spouse. I just think that your definition is far too narrow to encompass all the forms of marriage that currently exist. Like your comments on that.
All right, Jay, thanks for the call. And David Blankenhorn, again, another relatively short question, but a lot of big ones inside there.
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and it's true that we don't make divorce and unwed childbearing illegal, but it's true that many people, including me, think that our high rate of divorce is a problem, and I wish it were lower. And many people, including me, think that a very high rate of out-of-wedlock childbearing is a serious social problem and would like to have it be lower. And I have spent, you know, 15 years publicly arguing for legal and value shifts in our society that would strengthen the institution of marriage in precisely these areas. I don't think divorce should be outlawed, but I think we could take steps to make it less common, and that would be a good thing. And I certainly think that it is wrong to have children outside of marriage. And I think we should take steps as a society to do better in this area. So I don't, the idea that marriage has weakened in recent decades is, to me, the way I respond to that trend is to say, well, gosh, that's a problem. Let's do something about that. And not to say, because it has weakened, well, let's go ahead and do something that would probably weaken it further. That is not my response. And as for the second part of the question, which is, well, aren't there other purposes of marriage other than having children? The answer is yes, there are. Absolutely. There's no qualification to that. So your caller's making a good point. I would simply say, at the same time, that the single most important cross-cultural foundation for marriage is this notion of the mother-father, two-parent family structure. But are there other purposes? Yes. Now, as far as people who get married and either can't or don't have children, that doesn't require us to, that fact does not require us to change our definition of marriage. Whereas allowing same-sex couples to marry and carry with into that marriage institution the parental rights that are connected to marriage would require us to change the definition of the institution itself. And so I do think there's a distinction to be made there.
David Blankenhorn is our guest. He is the author of the book recently published, The Future of Marriage, and we are talking about definitions of marriage and what the future of that institution might hold. If you'd like to join in the discussion, you can do so at 800-642-1234. In Madison, it is 263-1890. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine this morning. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 18 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Former Vice President Al Gore went before Congress yesterday to talk for action against what he calls a climate crisis in the world. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests talk about the politics that are behind global warming. That's up next here on the Ideas Network. For the remainder of this hour, we continue our discussion with David Blankenhorn. He is the author of the book, The Future of Marriage. And we're talking about the future of marriage and changing definitions and definitions that David Blankenhorn has worked hard to come up with. Let's go back to the phones right now, and Rich joins us. He is in Sullivan this morning. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. I tuned in late, so maybe some of this has already been observed. But my reaction to Mr. Blankenhorn is that, gee, and I thought I was an idealist, to argue, and I'm not prepared to argue totalities of cross-cultural concepts anthropologically or philosophically, but I do know from even light reading that marriage has changed throughout history, that the concept of something, say, like Levite marriage is something no longer observed by any religious body that I know of. Perhaps it is among adherents of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, but I'm a strong advocate for divorce as progress in society, and I don't mean divorce lightly taken or lightly considered, the Hollywood style of revolving door marriages, but I really do believe marriage throughout history was a contract that for the longest time was unavailable to the lower classes. And when it became available, okay, it took on new and religious dimensions, and that to carry those through into the law of a republic as though that is the only interpretation of marriage that is legitimate. Mom and dad in a 50s-style union with the two or more kids, Ozzie and Harriet, I think is idealism beyond where I care to go in thinking about marriage now or in the future. I just don't think it exists save in the minds of certain people who want to idealize marriage and say what kinds of marriages are right and what kinds of marriages are wrong. They're contracts.
All right, Rich, I think we've got a pretty good handle on what you're thinking there. And in your book, David Blankenhorn, you cover the history of marriage at length, actually, in more length than I was almost prepared to handle. But there is a lot of history there. And how does that history, and I think it gets back to Rich's point, how does that history wind up where we are now? And I guess the other part of his point is aren't you just being a bit idealistic in your definition?
Well, yes, I'm being idealistic, but I mean, if it's idealistic to say with marriage advocates through the ages, if it's idealistic to say that we have this ideal for our children, that when they're born in our society, we want the two people whose physical union made them to be there for them, to help love and nurture and raise them into adulthood, We want those two individuals not merely to be the biological parents, but to be the social parents and to form this partnership with one another to care tenderly for one another and to care tenderly for the child. If that is idealism, then I plead guilty. I'm an idealist. I want that. I embrace and support that, and if that's idealistic, so be it. All marriage cultures, all cultures that have had marriage, have been idealistic in this way. And I think we should not abandon that form of idealization or that aspiration for our children. You know, as to the point about, it's not true, by the way, as one of the previous callers said, that marriage used to just be all about property. That's a frequently made assertion that's just not true. It's also not true that marriage was unavailable to poor people. That's just not true. There are a lot of... The other point is, when someone says the only thing we can say about marriage is that it's always changing, that's not true either. When someone says marriage is always changing, my response is, yes, marriage is always changing. But what is the thing that's always changing? Tell me what it is. Without using the word marriage, tell me what the thing is that's always changing. If we say the game of baseball is always changing, or ballet is always changing, or jazz is always changing, there's still something called baseball and jazz and whatever the other one was that's always changing. Tell me what it is that's always changing, and then we can talk. In human history, what the thing is that's always changing is the socially approved sexual union of the male and female, primarily so that their children are going to have an identifiable mother and father. That's the thing that's always changing. So that, you know, it does. It's kind of a you hear it often, but it doesn't get us very far to say the only thing we can say about marriage is it's always changing. No, there is something there that's always changing, and we have to decide how we feel about it.
Got an email here I'd like to read from Patty, who asks, is marriage becoming weaker in American society? It seems as though we don't value or encourage marriage as much as other cultures do, and that's why we're seeing less marriage today. How does your guest feel about this, and what can we do as a society or the government can do to strengthen or encourage marriage that will last? So I guess, well, first of all, is there really less marriage today?
Well, there is somewhat less, and although most Americans marry, about 90% of Americans marry, and the overwhelming majority of those marriages produce children, and most children today are being raised by their own mother and father or who are married to one another, so it's not like the game is up, but I think the person who wrote the email was absolutely correct to say that it's gotten a lot weaker. We have high divorce rates, we have high rates of out-of-wedlock childbearing, we have very fast growing rates of non-marital cohabitation. So, yes, there are serious challenges to the integrity and coherence of the institution. There are also things that can and are being done at all levels of society to strengthen marriage. There are things that community and religious and public policy people are doing, and I've been involved in those for many years, and it's a very important and, to me, rewarding aspect of the challenge we face as a society. You know, there's nothing inevitable about the weakening of marriage. It can be made stronger. For example, during the late 1990s, the proportion of African-American children in the United States living with their two married parents actually ticked up a bit, and very encouraging news. So whether or not marriage gets stronger or weaker is something that we're deciding right now based on our actions.
Is it something the government needs to be involved with, though?
Well, the government is involved already. Every day, when it taxes people based on marital status, when it establishes laws of marriage and divorce, entry and exit into the institution, government is deeply involved in marriage all the time. So the question is just in what ways can law be a good custodian and a good support for the marriage institution?
Let's go to another phone call right now, and we head to Milwaukee, and Chris joins us. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I'm sorry. As I see it,
my humble opinion, I think that marriage is about monogamy, and monogamy is about STDs. It's about diseases that can be spread through a population, and it makes absolute sense that there would be that all the populations that are left practice monogamy, because those that didn't would have perished from all the diseases that would have run rampant in this in that society. And as far as children, it doesn't take two parents to raise a child. It takes a village to raise a child. You know, we should be doing things to help children instead of spending less and less money per child and more money per person ready to die. If we really value children, yes, as a society, we would get in and we would help all families. We would help single families. But to say that marriage is about children, I don't see the connection.
Chris, thanks for the call. And let's take the first point first. And, you know, she offered a very pragmatic viewpoint for marriage, monogamy, and safety from STDs.
Well, marriages everywhere have valued and tried to enforce as best they can the notion of sexual fidelity. And so, you know, obviously disease is one aspect of it. I don't think it's been the central reason why it's done this, but it's been it's an issue. It's always an issue. And so as far as the point about it takes a community or it takes a village, it certainly does. But the building blocks of a successful village that raising children are going to be this mother-father unit. It's not a question of do we want a village or do we want parents. We want both. And so I don't really see a conflict.
Later on in your book, as you take a look ahead to what the future might hold, you discuss and have the results of surveys that have been done in various countries regarding marriage and what is happening there now. And I'd like you to talk a bit about that survey process and some of what you found.
Well, there were these two international surveys. One of them surveyed about 30 countries, and one of them surveyed about 80 countries. And they ask a lot of questions about marriage, like, do you think it's okay to have a child outside of marriage? Do you think marriage is an important institution? Do you think that a troubled marriage should stay together for the sake of the children, or do you think that you should choose to have a divorce if you're unhappy in your marriage? A number of questions that would indicate support or non-support for the, let's just call it, I don't like the term, but let's just call it the traditional marriage. You know, how enthusiastic are you or how supportive are you of marriage as a strong social institution as it's been traditionally defined? So I calculated all that, and then I looked and I tried to, I said within all these countries of the world, which ones have gay marriage, which ones don't have gay marriage, and which ones have civil unions. And then the fourth category I had was which ones have gay marriage in some part of the country. And the United States would be an example. We have gay marriage in Massachusetts. So I made these categories, and then I correlated the responses. And what I found out was that the more likely, the closer you get to gay marriage, the less likely, the lower support you have for traditional marriage in terms of these other issues. So in other words, the point I'm making is that the point that the data show is that acceptance of gay marriage goes along with skepticism or distrust of the institution of marriage. If you believe that, you know, divorce on demand is good, is fine, if you believe that out-of-wedlock childbearing is fine, if you believe that marriage is an old-fashioned institution that probably needs a lot of changes, you're going to be likely to support gay marriage. If you believe that the divorce rate's way too high, that out-of-wedlock childbearing is wrong, and that we need to strengthen marriage as a social institution, it's likely that you're not going to support gay marriage. So these attitudes cluster together, and that's really what that section of the book shows.
Let's take another phone call right now. We go to Green Bay, and Bridget is with us. Hi, Bridget.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is an important topic, and I'd like to ask your guest about gay and lesbian couples who are already raising children. We have many in our country and around the world. So how do reproductive technologies and adoption change the conversation? Because it seems like then those couples would fit the guest definition of marriage. So thank you.
Thank you. David Blanken?
Well, it's a good subject because there are a lot of households with gay and lesbian people in them who are also raising children. And for people who believe that we should have gay marriage, that's a strong point on their side, and that's a point against my argument. So I accept that point, because if we had gay marriage, that would offer additional protections for a lot of these children. And so that's a good thing. And so, you know, there's nothing easy about this question. You're weighing good things that are in tension with one another. As far as the reproductive technology and the other part of your questioner's inquiry, it's not true that in gay and lesbian households that you're going to meet this traditional, this, you know, notion of the mother and the father whose union makes the child are there to raise the child. There, by definition, that is not going to happen in any gay or lesbian household raising children. There's always going to be, if it's a single person, most children in gay or lesbian households are the children of women who had the child heterosexually, usually then divorced their husband and then established a partnership with a woman who's not related to the child. That's the majority of cases. So they're really children of divorce whose second partner is a same-sex partner. And then in the other cases, if you're dealing with artificial insemination and contract pregnancy and the other possibilities, in every one of those cases, there's a third-party participant. There's someone donating eggs or sperm, or there's some other participant in that's actually the biological second parent is going to be someone who's not a part of the household. So it's not really the same as what I'm saying. But the point I want to underline is that your caller is making a point to say that for those households, whoever the adults are, were they allowed to marry, that probably would be beneficial to those children. And that's a strong point in favor of gay marriage. And I don't deny it for a moment. I just say that we have to look at all the factors.
And I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. David Blankenhorn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
David Blankenhorn has been with us for the past hour, the author of the book, The Future of Marriage. And we've been talking with him about the future of marriage as an institution. He is also the president of the Institute for American Values. If you'd like a copy of the program, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program 322C. Or you can also go to our website at wpr.org and listen online. Carmen Jackson produced this hour. We had on-air production from Karen Prager. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.